Misha has been a longstanding leader in the homeopathic community now for a number of years. He's the founder and principal of the School of Homeopathy, Devon, in England. And he was also made a fellow of the Society of Homeopaths in the UK for outstanding services to homeopathy. He's really been involved in homeopathy since the early days of its recent revival. He's a founding member of the British Society of Homeopaths, and he's an internationally recognized and respected teacher and clinician. And I also have the good fortune of teaching in a school in Japan where Misha also teaches. And although I've never met Misha personally, I'm very, very excited to have him join us for today's teleconference interview, because a mutual colleague and friend of ours, Dr. Will Taylor, has for many, many years now told me that Misha is one of his favorite homeopathic educators and practitioners in the community, one of the nicest guys he knows, and somebody who I absolutely have to study with. So it's really my great honor and pleasure to welcome you today, Misha.
Well, thank you, Kim. I was just thinking that we've probably seen videos of each other.
I think that's correct.
Yeah, I've certainly seen videos of you teaching in Japan.
Oh, yes,
and,
that's great.
And I've just appreciated
well,
how...
Hopefully we'll have an opportunity to meet each other personally. Maybe on one of our trips we'll overlap or something, and we'll have a chance to spend some time having sushi or something.
I certainly hope so.
Okay. So, Misha, I thought perhaps that you've been involved in the community for so long, and you know, you've been such an integral part of what we do in terms of our education and practice in homeopathy. I'm curious, how do you see the relationship between the art and the science of homeopathy, and how do you manifest that in your own personal life?
Hey, Kim, before I go directly into answering that question, I'd just like to tell you a little story, which is it's topical. Today is the Glastonbury Fair over in England, and this is the main music festival, or the largest music festival. And two of my boys are there playing on various stages because they're in bands. And in 1971, I was at the first Glastonbury Fair, but not as a musician. I was there as a cameraman making a movie of that fair. And that date, 1971, marked a transition in my life between being a filmmaker and being a homeopath. Hmm. In 1971, I was primarily a homeopath, and filming at the Glastonbury Fair was my swan song. It's the last film I ever made.
Hmm.
So that's, you know, that bears upon the question of the art and the science.
That's great.
In a roundabout way.
Great.
Just to say that I come from a family of artists. That is to say, both my mother and father painted oil paintings. For my dad, that was his profession. And he was big in it in Europe prior to the Second World War, which disrupted so many people's lives, and my parents included. They were refugees in Britain and very happy to escape with their lives. But they also escaped their fame and fortune. So I come from a background of the arts, but with a great fascination for the sciences, which were, in fact, my best subjects at school. So bringing the two together is kind of implicit in my being, I would say. And for me, it's effortless. In fact, there isn't really a division. And the way I see it, great science derives from exactly the same place as great art.
Very true, isn't it? Misha, can you still hear me?
I can, perfect.
Okay, good. Now, I know, Misha, you've done an extensive amount of work both with Eastern esoteric and also Western esoteric practices and various types of world views. Can you share a little bit about that and how it's informed your understanding of homeopathy?
Well, again, I can tell you stories. That's much easier than telling you how it informs my homeopathy.
Sure.
You know, it's easier to go in the roundabout route than the direct one. Coming from a family of artists, I also came with the ability to look at lots of art books. And what fascinated me the most was always the art of the East, especially China, Japan, and India. So that's my first contact with the Eastern tradition. It's not the esoteric tradition, but it's a view into the soul world of the East. And then following on from that, I was fascinated by yoga as a teenager, and studied yoga for a number of years, not because I'm actually very much in touch with the physical side of yoga, but because I'm fascinated by the philosophy and by meditation practice. My teacher, however, was, you could say, a fundamentalist Hindu teacher who began with asanas, then went to pranayama, and eventually ended up in meditation, the whole process taking four-year periods in each. And I never quite made it through to meditation. but the fascination's been there all along, you know.
Sure.
And there are various moments in my life prior to homeopathy, my life as a filmmaker, when the East has caught me and reminded me once again of where central practice is for me.
Hmm.
So, around 1971, when the transition was kind of midway, I was researching a series of films purportedly for the BBC on the subject of the, I guess we would call it the hippie event that happened in Britain, which is slightly different from the way in which it happened in the US, still informed by hallucinogenic drugs, of course, but a similar phenomenon to the US phenomenon. And looking at the Eastern view was very much written into the script. You'll remember that the Beatles were greatly influenced by the Maharaji.
Sure.
And by TM. So, once again, it's one of those things which is so intertwined into the weaving of my life that it's very hard for me to separate them.
Mm.
The concept of the vital force was an absolute obvious for me. I didn't need to be told twice. I already knew about that.
Right.
And as for the like yours like principle, that's just common sense as far as I was concerned.
Sure.
When I heard about the principles of homeopathy, I was a lover at first sight.
Mm.
And I realized that within this discipline lay the key to healing. Straight away, I did. You know, it just. What could I say? It was just obvious.
Yeah. How did you actually come across homeopathy, Misha?
Yeah, I came across it researching for this movie series.
Uh huh.
And through radionics.
Uh huh.
Radionics is and radiesthesia. Radiesthesia is detecting of subtle influences at a distance, and radionics, of course, is affecting the subtle body at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
The principle struck me as being as obvious as telepathic communication is obvious.
Mm.
It informs all of our lives, whether we consider it to be scientific or not.
So actually, before you got involved in homeopathy, you were doing radionics and radiesthesia.
No, that's not true.
Oh, it's not true.
I wasn't doing it. No, I've never actually done it.
Okay, you were just,
okay.
You were just interested in it.
Interested in it, yes.
I see, okay.
For me, radionics and radiesthesia misses a step.
Right.
And the step is simply having having the physical presence there of the substance, but actually it's not the physical substance. It's the beingness, that is to say, the energy field of the material substance. That step is important to me.
Mm, very interesting. Misha, I know I've heard you refer to something called agreements, which is something that you talk about relative to the topic of truth. Can you clarify that a little bit for us and what that's all about?
Okay, I've got you. Agreements, you said, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yes. Sure, I'd be delighted to clarify what I mean here. To my way of understanding it, almost all truths are relative. And I say almost all because we consider like yours, like principle, for instance, to be an immutable truth. For us it is so. And we would also consider the equal and opposite principle as being an immutable principle.
Right.
Gravity being immutable principles. But outside of these so-called certainties, there aren't many. Generally, we have agreements which are for the most part, culturally determined.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say a thing is true, what we mean is that a sufficient number of us agree on it, and therefore act as though it was truth.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like agreeing that we'll go when the light's green and stop when the light's red.
Mm-hmm. So this would be comparable to consensus of some type?
Yeah, totally.
Okay, all right.
And that just helps us, understanding that, just helps us to moderate our own internal fascist that would like to believe that it really is the way that our fathers and mothers told us it was.
Mm-hmm. And how do you use this in a homeopathic context? Just so.
Oh, I approach everything with doubt. Everything with it's like a kind of doubt. The older I get, the less certain I am about things.
I understand that.
Yes. So that understanding of agreements allows me to have little certainty with regard to what my patients are telling me, what I believe to be true or not true, and how homeopathy does and doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now, Misha, you've been involved in the homeopathic educational field for many, many years now. I'm curious, do you have a particular approach or philosophy? And also, could you tell us a little bit about the schools that you're involved in and also the distance learning program that you offer to people who can't actually attend an on-school situation?
Sure, Kim, I'd be delighted, but you've asked me a lot of questions.
I do. I'm sorry. I was trying to keep it as simple instead of compound questions. Sorry about that.
I tackle first.
So, yeah, you can take them one at a time, whichever one you'd like to start with. Or if you'd like me to rephrase it, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Because I've been talking slightly philosophically, I can talk very practically here. Distance learning program began because I started making tape recordings in class in order to allow students who'd missed a class to have a record of it, so I just passed them over the tape. They'd listen to it, then give it back to me. After a while, a library of tapes evolved, and I had this idea that from this library of tapes, it would be possible to construct a course that would act as a primer for students interested in homeopathy, that they could do that and then come to see me once they'd got the ABC of homeopathy under their belts. And we could go straight into casework and the more advanced aspects of case management and actually getting folks well.
Mm.
And for a number of years, I ran a school like that. The entrance point was Unit 1 of the correspondence course. The exit point was Unit 10 of the correspondence course. And then they started coming once a month for, at that point, it was two days a month, for a further 3 years in order to get the practice together. And then I realized that actually teaching the beginners was a lot of fun, that I felt I'd missed out from those many years of just going straight into practice. And so we started to take students from the beginning again and ran parallel courses, a correspondence course and an attendance course parallel for the first couple of years. And then we went into 3 years of what you might call internship, I suppose, if to take a more medical model.
Mm.
Mm. That's how the correspondence course began, and because I didn't want to administer it, I just wanted to get on with the business of being with folks, which is where my joy is.
Sure.
I farmed it out originally to Stuart Gracie, who did a fantastic job on it, and put it all together in a really tight package, which I had not done. That's how the correspondence course began.
Now, Misha, you know, I know there's a number of different correspondence programs out there. Could you share with us what you feel is unique or special about your particular program?
Sure, be delighted. On the outside, when you get it arriving through your door, what you see is that it weaves together sources of tape recordings in the classroom, which is very much alive and scintillating kind of dialogue feeling about it, especially written material which relates to the tapes, and of course cross-references to textbooks, so that the whole thing comes together in a unified whole. There are assignment questions which are not tick-box answers. They all involve writing essays, and they're all marked by what we call mentors, because they don't. The important thing is not the mark; it's the feedback. Mentors read what students have written and then feedback, often very extensively. So a personal relationship, a bit like the relationship between a pupil and a tutor, develops. That aspect, I think, does make it unique. From the inside, what's really important to me and to the way the school works is that all those who teach here share a unified vision of what homeopathy can do and how it can do it. So you get a pretty unified view about homeopathy, which has at its center a non-therapeutic approach, but rather a similimum approach. What we look for is the remedy that will put into order the out-of-order vital force from the core, working outwards to the symptoms, not from the symptoms working inwards to the core.
Now, you know, I know that there's, Misha, there's a lot of different views and ideas and approaches that are currently bantered around in the community relative to what homeopathy is or isn't. And I'm curious, how does your school address that? Do you guys offer a more of an eclectic approach?
No, we don't.
You stay with the fundamentals. What is your orientation? Just so.
Yeah, it's a good question. The first thing I'd like to say is I think that the fact that there's so much debate, and sometimes it looks as though it's really disruptive to the very core of homeopathy, I actually think it's a sign that homeopathy is alive, well, and kicking. And I really appreciate that it's there. I think it's great that Peter Chappell can produce his PC remedies and call them the second similimum and not tell anybody how he's done it. I completely disagree with him, fundamentally disagree with him. But I think that it's great that he's out there doing it.
Sure.
I just love the fact that we've got, you know, the lunatic fringe and the solid pedantic center all together in our community.
Right, right.
I'm more of the solid pedantic center man than the lunatic fringe man, in my opinion, although some may say otherwise. I actually think that Hanuman was right in most everything. What I mean by that is that I like the agreement. By right. I like the homeopathic agreement that he's forged together.
Sure.
In the Organon. And of course this is open to interpretation. He's not totally set on just one truth. Obviously, he's wiser than that.
Right, right.
I'm not answering your question now, which is what really informs my homeopathy.
Right.
And in short, what got me into homeopathy was not that like yours like, or the principle of the vital force, actually, nor was it the fact that we have at the root of our knowledge the practice of provings. It was the wondrous thing of the similarity between the source substance and the disease, which we call the doctrine of signatures. My first introduction to homeopathy was actually Clark's three-volume Materia Medica. It's a mad place to start, but the homeopath I asked for a book on homeopathy suggested this one, because she knew of no other.
Can you repeat the title again for us, Misha?
Sorry?
Repeat the title again?
Sure, it was Clark's Materia Medica.
Clark's Materia Medica.
Yeah.
The three-volume set.
That's the one.
Okay, yeah.
And I ordered that from a specialist bookshop. In the late 60s, actually, this was. And waited a couple of months for it to arrive and went into the bookshop and there were the three volumes, and I started reading them and walked out having bought them because I was so fascinated. And, you know, Clark is basically draws from various different disciplines
to
weave together a picture of the remedy that is very much doctrine of signatures.
Sure.
And I was just magicked away by it. That was it, as far as I was concerned. It was a love affair. That was it. I just wanted to say that it put those wonderful and lofty principles right into the ground from which the stuff grows and arises. And it joined up the two ends. You know, it's like the two ends of the rainbow.
Sure.
At which there are pots of gold.
Sure.
And at one end was the spiritual pot of gold, and at the other end was the material pot of gold, and it just joined them perfectly.
Mm.
And I said, right, that's it. This is the manifestation of the divine in health and ill health.
Right,
and
right.
And it's the way in which we're going to get ourselves better. That was it.
Right, right.
And that's how I teach homeopathy, from that sense of enlightenment, wonderment. You know, it's just astonishing.
Mm. So I'm curious, because do you find that you can always get the doctor's signatures to fit the remedy picture well, or do you find sometimes it's a little bit more challenging than at other times?
Sure, obviously.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, obviously.
Because with some remedies, it seems fairly obvious, but then, you know, you look at other remedies and it seems harder to make it fit for some reason. Or...
Totally mystifying.
Yeah, yeah.
How do we get from Cali Bic to ropey discharges?
Yeah, really. What is there about that substance that would precipitate such a symptom? Yeah, there's certainly an elegance and a beauty to the doctor's signatures when it fits, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah,
it's amazing. But the point is that even if you can't make it fit all the time, you know that it's there.
Sure.
Yeah. You look for it. You know, the sensation method of Sankaran is just right in the heart of this.
Right. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's all been told, really, rather better.
Yeah, but I mean, you're the way that you use it, or the way it's employed in your school, or how you see it fitting with the doctor's signatures. Yeah, anything you want to share?
Sure. I think I've said how it fits with doctor's signatures.
Yeah.
When you get to Rajan thinks of as the level beyond delusion into vital sensation, which is expressed by the whole being and the gestures and everything else, that is the person speaking from their core.
Mm.
And that core expression is the remedy. And if it's obvious to see, you'll see it.
Right.
And if it's not obvious to see, you'll have to look very hard to find the connections,
mm-hmm.
which is where things like the schema
mm.
can be helpful, and where Jan Scholten's periodic table can be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you to navigate into that center.
Sure. So, Misha, I'm curious, at this point, what percentage of your practice are you employing things like Sankaran's sensation method or Scholten's approach with the periodic table? Is it with almost every case? Or
yes.
Pretty much every case?
Just about every case.
Uh-huh. And have you found improvement in your results as a consequence of...
Ah, yeah, let me talk to you about that.
Yeah.
The quick answer is yes.
Yeah.
I find it very encouraging. But I have an idea about this.
Yeah.
Which is that there are three factors that are involved in getting somebody better. The first factors are the relationship. First of all, the relationship the person has to their healing process. Because some people actually don't really want to get better, and they won't. But the relationship I'm looking at perhaps most intensely is the relationship between the patient and the practitioner.
Mm.
That's got to have vitality in it. Otherwise, things won't happen. And the more vitality it has, the more that will happen. It has to be really effervescent, it seems to me.
Sure.
The next thing that's really important is the relationship that the practitioner has to their healing art. And this is how we approach the materials of with which we'll make the thing happen.
Mm.
It's a bit like the artist works with his oil paints. You know, it's a sensual experience. You put the paints on the palette and you put the brush in it, and it's got a texture and a smell and a color and a way of applying to the canvas. You experience it with your five senses, and it's imminent and real.
Yeah.
And obviously the practitioner has to have this.
Sure.
And the third element, which is as important as the other two or three, if you take patient relationship with their healing as the first, then it's three, isn't it? So that the last element is the most mysterious of all, and it's the one of with which we have over which we have absolutely no control.
Mm.
And sometimes you can call it the right moment.
Mm.
You know, the whatever you want, the kairos is the Greek term for it. or the, you know, the astrological passing of the planets in the right place, or just the something that's outside of our control. We have to honor all of these. Now, to the point where the practitioner is totally involved with all his senses and every part of his being with the materials that he uses. That's one of the essential ingredients. So if the homeopath has a complete enthusiasm for what the method they're using, it's going to work. And if they've become dull and like hard, stale paints in the tube, the painting's not going to happen. It'll need too much turpentine to get it flowing again. You know, it just won't be right. It won't stick. So that enthusiasm, that belief in what you're doing is really important. And every now and again, we need to be reawakened, it seems to me. And this is why new cutting edges are really important in the field of homeopathy or any field. We just need to become awake again, become enthusiastic again.
It sounds to me, Misha, like a lot of what you feel is important in the work of homeopathy is actual personal development on the practitioner's part, or a certain level of self-awareness or self-reflection. Would you say that's correct? Or?
No, actually. No, I don't think that's what I'm saying. Although I do believe in it. But I think it's a secondary. I think the most important thing is just involvement, joy, passion, belief. You know, those things. I think that's.
I would imagine there's some type of personal development that's involved in all of that.
I don't know, Kim. I don't know.
Yeah.
I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I know some practitioners who are bloody brilliant, and they don't go for personal development. Maybe they're already developed.
That's very funny. So now, Misha, I know that your school has done, and actually you yourself have conducted a number of different provings. I don't know if you know, but we actually conducted our very first proving out in Japan. Were you aware of that?
I was aware of the fact that that Masahiro was talking about and very excited about carrying out a proving.
Yeah, so we actually completed the first proving. There were about 40 people there. And it was the first formal proving I've been involved in. It was quite exciting, and I think we have a good substance to have chosen for the proving. I'm curious a little bit about your philosophy. You've done a lot of provings now.
Yeah.
Like, you know, why you choose a particular substance for the proving? What is your orientation? What are you hoping to achieve? Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
It's such a good question, but I can't give you a good answer. I can't give you a good answer because I'm not such a systematic person.
Uh-huh, okay.
I suppose I'm more inspirational than I am systematic. And sometimes it's just because it's there. You know, we did a proving of the oak gall wasp.
Okay,
Because the oak gall...
And the Latin name for that is?
Of course,
okay. Don't
I know what it is, but just give me a minute because I just call it oak galls.
Okay.
It's a Nopper oak gall.
Yeah.
Spelt with a K, K-N-O-P-P-E-R, Nopper oak gall. And it's unusual because it forms in the acorn itself and deforms it in a way that's actually quite, to a human eye, it looks very diseased indeed. It's kind of hideous.
Mm-hmm.
And the trees have been stressed around my way because land use had changed from cows to ploughing, and the trees were getting their roots cut, and they were getting stressed, and therefore susceptible, and all these deformed oak apples were falling at my feet. So it was a good enough reason to do the approving of it, or for instance, approving that I consider to be an important substance, positronium, very
right.
Important actually.
And how did you choose positronium?
I didn't.
You didn't.
Chris Kurtz chose it. He was at the time a PhD student in his last year at in California, and I was giving a seminar, and he was student of homeopathy. So he said, "Would you be interested in proving antimatter?" And I said, "Pull the other one; it's got bells on it." and he said, "Well, no, I'm serious. It's went on to explain, and I said, absolutely, of course. What could be more fascinating than that? And Falcon is one of the few that I had a real rationale for proving, which was that I had a patient who had done reasonably well on a couple of previous remedies, but hadn't come round to full good health, and so I got to thinking, what on earth can I give this woman? And I thought of the only similimum I could think of was something that had been subjected to extreme torture, basically, in order to discipline it by humans, because only humans do something as extraordinary as that.
Right.
And Falcon came to my mind, and lots of elements of the case then fitted in.
Mm-hmm.
So we gave her Falcon unproved,
mm-hmm.
and it was, you know, it moved her on in her health journey, and then we proved it.
Mm. And how was the proving relative to your expectation of the remedy beforehand? Did it come out similar to what you expected, or?
I tried to go into it naive.
Yeah.
Certainly, at that point, I was more naive. It some years ago.
Yeah.
It was wonderful to see it unravel in the way that it did. I mean, things
right.
like. The next day, we did the proving on Friday night, and on Saturday the provers had a party, and quite a few of them went to the same party, and they had great trouble getting off traffic roundabouts. You call them turning circles, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Roundabouts, yeah.
They
yeah.
just went round and round and round and couldn't work out how to get off them. and on Sunday morning, five of them, including two of the men, had came with painted toe and fingernails, because they'd done that at the party. They'd got out their paints, and they sat there with their painted claws, well, talons.
Mm.
Things like that were occurring,
mm.
where you just go, yes, well, I wished I could tell them they were proving Falcon, because they'd fall about.
Right, that's very interesting. The reason I asked that question, Misha, is because a number of years ago, my wife was helping, what's her name now? Just give me my mind. Nancy Herrick on her book of provings, and she was doing a proving of lotus. And, you know, lotus, I know you're involved in a lot of the spiritual Eastern traditions, and as you are well aware, lotus is a symbol of enlightenment. But if I remember correctly, that proving was full of the most horrific, violent type of information. So that's why I asked you that question, if it was anything similar, because sometimes it seems that it isn't, and yet sometimes it is. So
right, got you.
Yeah.
You got a polarity picture coming out in lotus.
Yes,
which we now know to expect.
Right, right.
And what I was mentioning about Falcon was not polarity; it was primary.
It was primary, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, are you guys planning on doing... how many provings have you done so far?
Oh, God, Kim, I'm sorry. Don't ask me. Somewhere
well, approximately. Is it 10 or 20 or 50?
10
provings so far.
10 or 12, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and mostly these provings are available... You haven't published books on them, have you? Mostly they're available electronically, either in the software programs and something like that.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And are you guys continuing... Are you planning on doing ongoing provings, or...?
We do them annually.
You do one annually?
Yeah.
Okay, and do you follow a particular protocol every time, or is it different?
We do. I can say a few things about that. I'd be delighted.
Okay.
The first is third-year students do the proving. Fourth-year students are their supervisors.
Okay.
And in this, the prover models the patient and the supervisor models the practitioner. So it's incredibly useful experience within a school
mm-hmm.
For very many different reasons, not the least, those particular dynamics. Interesting
sure.
to explore. It's the single most important teaching tool that we have. It's just amazing.
Mm.
And it's most amazing, I guess, because it shows people the power of the single dose, and in our case, actually quite a low potency.
Mm-hmm.
We only give unit doses. So
What potency do you do your provings in usually? Or?
30s.
30s, okay.
These days, this is what we do these days. We run it up in class.
Yeah.
Starting off with something, some liquid form, so that the substance is hidden, disguised, as a 4C or 3C, whatever it might be. And we'd run it up to 30 in Korsakovian manner, and then take some.
Mm-hmm.
And what we discovered from our first proving onwards is that there is a field effect amongst the provers, which is such that whether or not they take the remedy, they will be affected if they're susceptible.
Mm-hmm. In other words, even those people who receive placebo seem to
we very quickly stop giving placebos.
Yeah, if you don't get placebos, or you do?
No, in this environment, there's no point.
There's no point.
No, because we've proved that the placebo placebo prover is as likely as the non-placebo prover to be influenced by the substance.
Right.
So you can't have a placebo. It doesn't work. It's
sure.
No, not in this environment.
Right.
Not in a group proving. And we also have established, same as everybody else who's done group provings, that sometimes the proving effects occur before the proving has actually taken place.
Right.
This is very disturbing, because it means in the field of energetics, time is not just in the present.
Right.
It's also in the past.
Sure.
In other words, where there's no material content, the laws of time don't hold as they do within the material universe.
Right.
Which
right.
is exactly what Einstein said about time, in fact.
Sure.
You know, it always amazes me that scientists, so-called, balk at these ideas, saying they're non-scientific.
It's very true. I don't know if you had a chance, Misha, to see the University of Connecticut conducted a debate a number of months ago with people who were from the scientific community who were anti-homeopathy and then advocates for homeopathy. Did you get a chance to see that?
I didn't, know.
That's well worth watching. It's actually still up on the University of Connecticut website.
I'll take a look.
And it's fascinating, actually. And I think anybody who was unprejudiced who went and observed that debate would come away convinced that homeopathy had some level of efficacy and that the criticisms were basically unfounded. I mean, I think if you're prejudiced and you go and you watch it, you might come away with a different feeling. But if you're really unbiased and you watch it, the homeopaths won the argument very, very handily. And the reason I mention it to it is because one of the fellows who's on there is actually not even a homeopath. He's a material scientist, and he's the guy who advocates most strongly for homeopathy, which is fascinating because, you know, he says from a scientific point of view, there's no reason that homeopathy can't work. And just reiterating what you were just saying, so it's fascinating.
Good. Well, I look forward to having a look.
It's fabulous. Yes, actually, I think Masa was planning on having the thing translated into Japanese for his students because it was
so good.
It's
that good, huh?
Yeah. So are you guys going to, are you planning on conducting, so you're going to do one a year, basically?
Yes, we'll be doing a new proving in October.
Okay, that's fantastic. And what about any future plans for the school, any projects you guys are working on, anything you'd like to share before
I
open it up to the general audience?
Yeah, the school's moving its location.
Say it again?
It will be moving its physical location.
Oh, you're moving your location. Where are you guys going to?
We're going to a town called Stroud in Gloucestershire.
Uh-huh. And you're moving from which town now?
We're moving from a rural location in the southwest of England.
Oh, okay. And any particular reason you guys are moving your location? Or?
Yeah. The school has been in the family home.
Uh-huh.
And now all our kids have left us, so we're just the two of us and the school in our family home. And it's time to change things.
Sure.
It's just simply that. And I'm 65 now.
I hear you. Will you still be involved in the school in terms of teaching and things like that?
Very much so.
You will be, okay.
I'll be just as involved from
great.
That interview.
And who are the other principal instructors there at the school?
You'll know Janet Snowden, maybe.
Janet Snowden, sure.
And you know Dave Mundy, maybe?
Yeah, I know David, yep.
Yeah. So these two people started working with me in the school in 1984. 82 and 84. So we have a very long association together.
Mm.
In fact, I would say the three of us are the School of Homeopathy,
mm-hmm.
the core of the teaching.
That's great. And are you guys, so you're moving your school, anything else? Any other things you guys are working on, books or new programs or?
We've just got out a first aid course plus remedy kit.
Actually, your son Manny showed that to me when we were together in Rhode Island.
Right.
It looked fantastic, actually.
Yeah, it looks good. This is something that was on my back burner for ages, and Manny just got it out and put it on the front and put it together. He's very much a man of action, Manny.
Yeah, he did a very good job with that too. It looks aesthetic.
He has, hasn't he?
Yeah, very good. Yeah.
That's his. Like I was in films before. He was in graphics, marketing, packaging. You know, all of that.
Oh, yeah, that's great. It's nice to have that talent in the family.
It's very useful.
So that's great. And that's a program that anybody can take. You don't have to be a student of the Devon School already, or it's just an independent program.
Anyone can take it.
And what we need to do is, if people want more information about your distance learning program or studying at the school, you used to have a branch in New York, but now that's no longer the case. Is that correct?
A branch in Europe.
You had a branch in New York as well, didn't you?
Oh, New York. Yes. We had an on-site school in New York.
Right.
It's a loose partnership, but originally modeled after the school quite closely, and then going in its own direction under Joe Daly's... Inspired. Joe Daly's wonderful.
Lovely lady. I like her
lovely
very much.
Lovely lady. Wonderful homeopath. Absolutely dedicated to the craft.
Yep.
And, she developed the school along slightly different lines, but not greatly so. And it's been a really lovely experience, but it's coming to an end. You're right.
Right. So you're not, there won't be any addition, you won't be opening another branch anywhere in the United States as far as you're aware.
What is it, on-site?
On-site, yeah.
On-site. That's not a plan for the immediate future.
Either if they want to study with you guys, they got to study through the distance learning program, or they got to go to England.
Either or, yeah.
Okay, all right, just so I understand. Good. And information on your website, URL or email contact information?
Sure, it's www.homeopathyschool.com.
Okay.
So it's homeopathy.
And if somebody wants to send an email or call, well, how would they do that?
Sorry?
If they would want to send an email or make a phone call, how could they do that?
Oh, just go to the website and everything will be revealed.
All that information is there. Okay, fantastic. All right, great. Well, I'm going to open it up and let some other people ask some questions.
Okay,
is there anything else you'd like to share before I do that?
Yes, there is, actually.
Okay, go ahead.
I guess most of the people listening in will be practitioners or possibly student practitioners, but I guess mostly practitioners. So there's something that I'd like to share with you, and it's about not burning out, really, because it's something that that happens a lot in the practice, in all sorts of different ways. People get tired, and when they do, their practices tend to falter. And right now in the UK, in a climate where homeopathy is being lambasted. It's difficult for practitioners to make ends meet, and many are dropping out of practice, and it really makes me sad. And what I'd just like to say to you is just take care of your souls. The S-O-U-L, take care of your soul. Because advice you're given in aeroplanes to put the oxygen mask on yourself first before you help your child or your neighbor.
Mm.
It's exactly the same in practice. You know, just look after yourself first, and it's about staying focused in yourself. Really, that's very important. Don't lose focus. Don't lose awareness. Stay aware. Stay focused. Stay young. Stay enthusiastic. Stay believing in yourselves and believing in homeopathy. And patients will come because, you know, it's a bit like being out in a cold, dark night when you're sick. What you look for is a beacon and warmth. And you, the practitioner, are that beacon and that warmth. So you have to just make sure that you really do shine.
Well, thank you for those lovely words of wisdom. That was very beautiful. Could you just before I open it up, though, could you just let people know, because they may not be aware of what's been happening in Great Britain relative to the attack on homeopathy. So do you want to just let people give them a quick rundown on that so they know?
Well, I don't think it's different from anywhere else in the Western world, actually.
But it's been more aggressive in Great Britain recently, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah, it seems like it.
A lot of articles and journals. And
that's right.
Yeah.
I can't say much more than that, Kim.
Okay.
It's right now. It feels like a hostile environment.
Yeah.
And it's easy to feel discouraged by it.
Yeah. I've been hearing similar feedback from people in England. They feel quite. I was speaking to. The English representative. What's his name? Phil Edmonds, and he was telling me things are tough there, but.
Anyway. Mm. Yeah,
all right, so let me, Misha, thank you again. I'm going to open it up and let some other people ask some questions. Hold on one second.
Sure, delighted.
Hi, can people hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Does somebody have a question for Misha Norland?
I do. I'm interested to hear that we're approving new remedies left and right, and I was wondering if there were any plans with the school to prove underproved remedies that we don't see well represented in the repertories or in the Materia Medica. For instance, many of the nosodes don't show up well when we're looking for them. Any thoughts on that? And my second question is whether your Mappamundi book is going to be available soon. I understand it was under revision and was going to be republished.
It's been forever and a day, hasn't it? I know. I apologize for this. As a matter of fact, I was just working on the index the day before yesterday, literally. The index is, of course, the last thing in a book. So that's a way of saying...
You're getting
it's
close.
It's ready.
Hooray.
It's going to go to the printers in a couple of weeks. That kind of ready.
Excellent.
Yeah. Thank goodness. I remember Jeremy saying that about his book, the one on syphilis, that it was like a cup of tea he'd been carrying around for a very long time, and it was definitely time to put it down.
Good. Well, I hope your cup finds its saucer soon.
Yes. And in regard to proving nosodes, it's a really good idea. I just noticed a new proving of carcinosin has come out and is available on the net.
Oh, who conducted that proving?
I can't remember now, but if you just take a look, you'll find it.
Okay, great.
Just Google carcinosin, it will turn up.
Mm-hmm.
So it is happening. The next proving I want to do actually is not a nose. It's something else. I'm just really curious about it, so...
So you're not going to tell us what it is.
No, I can't tell you what it is.
Just keep our anticipation, yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have another question, or did...
That's it from me right now.
Okay, great. Well, thank you. Any other questions for Misha Norland?
I have a question. I was a student of School of Homeopathy in New York. I finished the 4 years. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to really start my practice because of, personal issues. But I'm having a hard time finding a supervisor who is still rooted in the basic wonderful principles that I studied at the School of Homeopathy. And it seems as though everyone is, experimenting or going with sensation, basically. And I'm a bit discouraged because I really want to be rooted in the foundation that I gained, because I think that's where my strength will be.
Right.
I have to be strong there.
Right.
And so in lieu of not being able to find a supervisor, how do you best advise someone in my position to re-enter the arena? And actually, I'm starting my practice fresh after, about 4 years now.
Sorry, how many?
Excuse me?
How many years did you say?
It's been about 4 years.
Oh, yeah.
Since I graduated.
Yes. It's about reawakening, it's about reawakening, coming awake to it again. The best way to do that, it seems to me, is to find a person or an organization that inspire you. Probably it's going to be a person.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I would go to a conference where you can get to hear various persons talking about homeopathy and find the one with whom you have an interest, some kind of inspiration from that person, and talk to them is what
right.
I would suggest.
Right. Which is one reason I tuned into this teleconference. And I thank you. It's so wonderful to hear you speak on homeopathy today.
Thank you.
Are you still in the New York area? Is that correct?
I'm actually back and forth between New York and Florida.
Okay. And basically you're looking for a supervisor. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. All righty.
You have some ideas, Kim?
Well, yeah, you know what? If you wanted to give me a call afterwards, I could try to hook you up with somebody who maybe could help you.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay. You have my phone number?
I do not.
Okay, I'll give it to you. It's 707-822-5807. You can call me tomorrow, and I'd be happy to help you.
I'm sorry. Would you run that one more time?
Yeah, it's 707-822-5807.
5807.
Great.
Thank you.
We just have a few more moments, so anybody have some questions they'd still like to ask? We've got about 5 or 6 minutes left. So any other questions? We don't normally have the opportunity to speak with somebody with so much clinical and educational experience in the homeopathic community, so this is a real opportunity. So take advantage of these few moments.
I really heard the last caller's call for help with the supervision. I'm not quite to that level yet, but I'm curious about the future. And I've had advice to go into practice with a group so that I would have their support and be able to bounce off of like-minded people versus going into practice alone. And I tend to be a loner, so I'm afraid of the group thing, but I'm thinking that's probably a really good idea. I was wondering if there was any general thoughts on how to begin practice more structurally than the actual individual thing, because of course that'll be an individual experience. But
okay, I think I've got that. There are two opposing thoughts that arise in my mind, just as they arose in yours.
Yeah.
I can only mirror back to you what you're giving me.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So one is, it's a really good idea to be with a group because you can share and learn a lot, and absolutely, I agree with you. And the other is, but I'm a loner, so I'm going to go into it on my own. So all I can say is, why don't you do both?
Mm-hmm.
Go into it on your own, because that's what you've got to do anyway. Actually, it's like your first breath. You make that on your own.
But something else.
And then pretty soon you're going to think, it's going to be interesting to run this past some other people, if only just to say this was my experience.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that you'll be in a dialogue with people who have different experiences and will be able to add to your store of knowledge. And it's such a, you know, if you've got a group around you, they would love to know about you. They'll welcome you with open arms, and maybe it doesn't feel like that sometimes if you're a loner kind of person.
Right.
It may feel like circles are shut, but actually in this case, circles will be open.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. You've helped me step back from the picture a little bit. I see it.
Mm.
Good.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Yes, please. Go ahead.
Hi, Misha. I'm living here in Canada, and a couple of years ago, I believe, you came to Canada to have a seminar weekend. I think it was a weekend. It might have been 5 days.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you were having any plans to come in the near future back to Canada.
Oh, I can answer that very simply.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is firmed up yet, but my thought was, since the New York school are having a bash at the beginning of June,
uh-huh.
It's a farewell to the school, and I will be there, of course.
Right.
But I would tag something on to that, like the second weekend in June, somewhere near New York. And actually, slightly, I was thinking north of New York, so close to the border with Canada.
I see. Okay.
And now that the Canadian dollar and the American dollar are more equal, I think it wouldn't. didn't make very much difference from a cost point of view, as long as we were near enough to an airport of some reasonable size.
Okay.
What do you think about that?
Are you talking to me or Kim?
I am talking to you.
Oh, to me? Well, I'll be honest. I'm being a little selfish. I'm on the West Coast, so I would like you to come back to Vancouver area.
Okay. I
was unavailable at the time,
okay.
And it's just so far apart.
That's simple.
But if you come to the East Coast, then I will still feel obligated that I do need to go this time, even if it is further.
Okay.
Isha, where in the East Coast, which city were you thinking?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I shouldn't say now. I have to leave that to Betsy, really, who lives there, to decide. Just to say to the woman in Vancouver, hi to you.
Hi.
I love Vancouver. I have one of my dearest friends living in Vancouver, Murray Feldman. And, of course, I'll be back in Vancouver. I couldn't not.
Excellent. I'll look forward to seeing you here.
Yeah, thank you.
Great. I think we have time for just one more question, so if somebody has a burning question they'd like to ask before we terminate the call, that would be fine.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
I know Misha wrote a book on miasms, which I haven't read, but...
Oh, yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
I have a question for him, whether today's day and age, when we have so much use of antibiotics and prednisone and all kinds of drug use, is that, can he comment on what's that's doing to curing of people with miasms that are difficult to cure? Of course, all miasms are, but how is that going to make it more difficult, and what does he do to unblock the drug usage impact on the miasm? If that's something he's dealt with at all in his practice.
That's pretty big.
I'm sorry to ask such a difficult question.
It's a very big question indeed. So, am I still... Are you still hearing me?
Yes, I'm listening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. It kind of two-pronged answer. First prong is, always if you can find the similimum, wonderful things happen. We all know that.
Yes.
We all know that. And even in cases that are miasmatically loaded, you could say, and confused by many drugs and vaccinations and what have you, it is still sometimes possible to find the similimum, and it's amazing what it does. And at best, it just sorts out all the problems. It needs repeating, of course, obviously, but it just gradually, the organism sheds the various shells that it's accreted around itself, if you see what I mean. But that isn't always possible. And sometimes there isn't time. That is to say, chronic diseases, once they've progressed to tissue changes, don't give you very much time. And then you do need to use other approaches. And I'm quite happy using nozodes as intercurrents in those cases. And not just nozodes, but when drugs have been in the picture for a particular length of time, or if they've... If there's a situation where a drug has caused a mal effect, I'm very happy to prescribe it, just on that alone. So it's a multi-pronged approach in cases with tissue changes.
What
if that's beginning to answer your question.
When there's a drug involved, do you describe that drug homeopathic? Is that what you're saying?
If it's caused mischief, definitely.
Okay.
And if somebody's been taking prednisolone, for instance, for years and years and years, this is a cortisone, isn't it?
Right.
A corticosteroid. Then it can be used, I'm very happy to try in all sorts of strange areas. And I'll tell you another thing too. In cases that are really complex. We were talking right at the beginning about radionics and radiesthesia. It wasn't my entrance point exactly. I wasn't a radiesthesic and radionic practitioner prior to homeopathy, but these days I will use it. I will use radiesthesia, that is to say dowsing, in order to determine what remedies to apply in really complex cases. That's thrown a cat among the pigeons, hasn't it?
Well, we're going to have to get a follow-up on that for the part two call for with you, Misha, in the future, because unfortunately we're out of time. But I did want to thank you so much. It was a wonderful call, and I'm sure everybody really enjoyed it. Can everybody say a big thank you for Misha for joining us on a Sunday afternoon in Great Britain.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.